The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Hey kids, I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast you're going to love. On behalf of myself, Morgan Rector, of one of the most horrific true crime podcasts, Human Monsters, I'd like to ask you this question. Do you like to travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Fun fact, there is a morgue on every cruise ship. After all, people die everywhere. Why wouldn't they die on a cruise ship in the Bahamas? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation, and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation. Hosted by true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband, and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and what-the-fuck stories of vacations gone horribly wrong. From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff, to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater. Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, accident or murder? But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers. Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor, takeaway, and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last. If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Welcome to Human Monsters. Secrets. We all have them. Whether your secret is something small, like stealing a fistful of candy when you were five, or big, such as being responsible for the ending of another's life, we carry it with us and, eventually, after a long time, that secret just becomes part of your anatomy, like a mole you hardly notice anymore, or a scar of which the outline you sometimes absent-mindedly trace once in a while. There is something about the word secrets, with its letters and sounds so seductive and sensual, that the vowels and syllables promotes and even demands that the compilation of words only be spoken in a whisper. A few secrets are good, such as the little box in your pocket contains a diamond engagement ring, or that a holiday will be spent in a tropical paradise instead of at home, doing DIY. But at the end of the day, secrets, good or bad, involve some form of lying, omission of truth, or deceit. Secrets encumber every part of our social structure. Companies often require employees to sign non-disclosure forms, and in a circle of friends, an affair can be so well hidden that the partner often ends up being the last to find out. Family secrets are, however, the worst kind of secrets to hold, purely because it often involves scandal, shame, and a sense of loyalty that leaves the secret holder often confused and questioning their place in the family unit. Some secrets are so diabolical that it could destroy a lifetime of perceptions, peace, and relationships between siblings, parents, or children. Just over the last couple of years, we have been privy to the royal family as they dodged the shrapnel as secret upon secret was revealed. Currently, the last member is awaiting his trial in the Piketon massacre, all because, like all septic secrets, once the knowledge and truth comes out, there is no going back, and the damage is irreversible. Just a note, as soon as the final sentence for Billy Wagner is delivered in Columbus in the case of the Piketon massacre, we will be doing a special episode on the case, which frankly is so unbelievable that if it wasn't for court transcripts and affidavits, you would be excused for thinking the whole sordid story is a script fabricated by a bored soap opera scriptwriter. Whether we like it or not, the old saying that you can choose your friends but you can't choose your family is one of those truths that for some of us might cut a little too close to the bone. Families are bound by blood and chained by the veins that carry not only the familiar DNA, but also imprints on us the character traits from our parents. It is, however, not always the same shared shape and color of an eye, or a hand gesture, or talent we inherit when we are part of a family. Within the walls of households, there often is an unspoken rule that whatever happens amongst relatives stays a secret, no matter how ugly, harmful, or destructive that secret might be. The story of Charlie Brandt is one of mainly secrets, some told far too late to prevent harm or demand consequences. I believe the Brandt family kept the secret for the benefit of their son, and I am sure that to this day, those who knew and are still alive regret every moment and opportunity they had to say something and save a life. But the bond between kin and the vow of silence amongst those you have known your whole life is stronger than any sense of responsibility. Whether their motive was shame, protection of a brother or son, or out of loyalty, the Brandt family kept Charlie's secret. Knowing the truth, all those involved hoped and prayed the incident that changed everyone's lives forever was a one-off experience. But they were wrong. Since sources often have facts that conflict about this case, we have decided to use Sean Morris's book, Invisible Killer, as a resource, which we highly recommend if you feel like taking a deeper dive into the case of Charlie Brandt. Elsa and Herbert Brandt met and married in their homeland of Germany, but after the birth of their eldest daughter, Angela, the young family sought greener pastures and decided to make the brave move to the United States of America. Germany had only been recovering from the Second World War for less than a decade, and the couple were determined to give their children the best opportunities life had to offer. Herbert was a hard-working man with strong family values, and when International Harvesters, a company that manufactures and sells farming equipment, made him the offer to work for them starting in Connecticut, he and the young family emigrated to the USA. They made the move in 1955, and on the 23rd of February 1957, the couple welcomed their second child, a boy they named Carl Eric Brandt, who we will be referring to from here on as Charlie. Herbert was both ambitious and motivated and moved up quickly in the corporation. He worked during the day and studied at night. This unfortunately meant the family frequently had to move. Herbert had done so well for himself that he could afford a holiday home in Florida, and after the birth of two more daughters a decade after Angela and Charlie, would purchase a home in Fort Wayne, Indiana in 1968, where they decided to settle. Where Angela was a social butterfly amongst her peers, Charlie seemed to be stuck in a cocoon woven by not only his own personality disorders, but by the frequent relocation he was subjected to. His grades were good, and he was clearly an intelligent boy, earning good grades, but he struggled to make friends during this time. He was overweight and introverted. As many lonely boys do, his dog, an old beagle, became his best friend, and the two would frequently go hunting for small game or on fishing trips with Herbert. Herbert was aware of his only son's struggles. He was described as meek and mild, but apart from including him in outdoor activities, felt that he had no other way to reach his son's troubled psyche and allow the boy to deal with whatever was burdening his second oldest child. Elsa and Herbert were, by all accounts, wonderful and doting parents, and I have no doubt that if the Brandts were faced with the challenge of a chubby child that was relentlessly teased at school and seemed to have no social skills outside his home, Charlie might have been able to get the treatment he needed, but in the 1960s and the 1970s, psychiatry and psychology was still highly experimental for adults, let alone children. The Kennedys, with their own treasure chest of secrets, hid a daughter for many decades, purely because she was mentally disabled, and even if the Brandts sought professional help, I doubt jamming an ice pick into his optical nerve or electroshock therapy would have changed the course of history. Many would speculate that it was an event that took place in December of 1970 that unlocked the door to let a monster out. The Brandt family fled the icy winters of Indiana often during this time and would spend vacations in Florida in their second home. During these trips, Herbert and Charlie would often go hunting, taking Charlie's dog with them. It was during one of these outings that Herbert shot and killed Charlie's furry friend. Sources vary, but it seems that Herbert shot into a bush trying to get the dog's attention after it did not respond to commands to return to the father and son. The dog had been shot twice, and Charlie, although not openly showing it, was shattered. Herbert took Charlie's almost non-existent response as a sign that all is fine, and the two dragged the body of the dog to a place where they could later bury it. They then returned, and a couple of days later, would pack up to return to Fort Wayne to prepare for the new year. The trip would take 16 hours by car, and Charlie, who would be returning to school as a freshman, must have felt a myriad of conflicting emotions about the loss of his best friend as the landscape slipped by with every mile. Back in Indiana, nothing seemed to be out of the ordinary. The cold winter had wrapped an especially icy arm around Fort Wayne, and on the 3rd of January 1971, the Brandt family had already resumed their normal activities, such as school and work. That evening, as the family enjoyed pork chops and green beans at the dinner table, Charlie's mother berated her son for an unfinished project. Elsa was 8 months pregnant at the time, and after the meal, she tucked 3-year-old Jennifer and 2-year-old Melinda into bed and decided to run a warm bath to relax. The family had recently purchased a color TV set, and the older children watched an FBI show before going back to the routine of the evening. The evening appeared normal as Herbert joined his wife, who was reading a magazine while soaking in the tub, to shave. The atmosphere was relaxed as Charlie sat at the kitchen table, working on his project, and Angela, who had retired to her own bedroom, reading a book. Charlie was, however, restless and retrieved his father's Luger firearm. What happened next would change the family's life forever. At about 9 p.m., Charlie walked into the bathroom where his parents were and first shot Herbert 3 times in the back. He then shot his pregnant mother 5 times as she lay in the tub. Angela would later say in a statement to police that she heard her father tell Charlie no and to stop. She also remembered her mother shouting for her to call the police. But before she could reach her door, Charlie stood on the threshold, eyes glazed, and aiming the gun at her. He pulled the trigger, but all it emitted was a dull click. Charlie had used all the bullets. He then attacked Angela, throwing her on the bed, beating her face repeatedly with his fists, and trying to strangle her. In a moment of pure desperation, Angela shouted for Charlie to stop, telling her brother that she loved him. This declaration seemed to have flipped a switch in Charlie's brain, and she would later claim that it was as if Charlie was suddenly normal, asking her in a confused way what he had done. Angela told him he had to get off her so they could figure things out together. Angela realized her life depended on her reaction, and she tried to calm her brother down, telling him that they will figure it out together and that they could take their little sisters and run away to a hippie colony. Amazingly, Charlie believed her and followed her down the stairs. She told him to fetch blankets for the toddlers because it was such an unusually cold night, and Charlie obeyed her. Halfway back up the staircase, Charlie turned to his sister and said, "Promise me you will never leave me, Angie." At that moment, he appeared so sad and pathetic, but Angela's fear was overwhelming. Angela promised, but the moment Charlie was out of sight, she flung open the front door and ran as if the devil himself was after her soul. Her torn and red splattered nightgown made the blood-curdling scream and the howling wind even more ominous. She ran to the first neighbor's house, tried the doorknob, found it locked, and started to run again. By now, Charlie had realized he had been betrayed. He stood on the front door shouting, "Angie, you promised! You promised!" At the second house, the occupants had still been awake, playing cards, and as Angela blurted out the events in shock, they called the police. 2 more phone calls would be made that evening regarding the tragedy. Charlie had calmly walked to the first neighbor's house, knocked on the door, and when the owners opened for him, he told them that he had killed his parents and they needed to call the police. Unbelievably, Herbert had survived the 3 gunshot wounds and was also able to call for help. In the aftermath, as 39-year-old Herbert lay in his hospital bed, recovering from his injuries and undoubtedly deep in mourning after the death of his wife and unborn child, he made a decision that would later come back to haunt him. The 2 toddlers slept through the entire ordeal as their 38-year-old mother lost her life, and Herbert had already made the decision that the 2 young daughters would be told their mother died in an accident. What they did not know would not hurt them, but all secrets find their way to the surface sometime. Charlie visited his father while in hospital and apologized for shooting him. Herbert, in return, apologized for killing his dog. "We have no witnesses for this exchange, but I have no doubt it was uncomfortable. So was Elsa and her unborn child's funeral, during which Herbert, who was bound to a wheelchair, gave his chained and shackled son a weak smile. Herbert had decided from the onset that he was going to support Charlie, no matter what. He refused to believe that the incident, which is how the family would refer to the crime afterwards, was nothing more than a once-off occurrence. Charlie was only 13 when he committed this crime, and as many parents would in his shoes, Herbert wanted a future for his son, which would include the best possible outcome from the investigation. Herbert told the police he had no idea why his son would have murdered Elsa or tried to kill him and Angela. Apart from the death of the dog, there were no outward signs that Charlie would commit the crimes he did. As a grand jury convened to discuss the fate of his son, Herbert drew his family tighter, even though Charlie never showed any remorse or had any explanation for his actions. The court had to decide whether Charlie was a danger in the future to society, and a total of 3 separate evaluations would be made by 3 separate psychiatrists about his mental state. They all agreed that Charlie was well-adjusted and a model patient who, despite his disconnect, loved his family and did not want to kill them. He claimed that it was as if he was programmed to kill. The grand jury felt uncomfortable about releasing Charlie back into society, but after a year in the mental institution, Herbert convinced all the relevant authorities that Charlie posed no threat, and the teenager was sent back to his family home in June 1972. Remaining in the house in Indiana seemed to be too emotionally challenging for all who kept the secret, and the family moved to their home in Florida to make a fresh start. Angela was struggling more than anyone seemed to acknowledge. She was constantly terrified of her brother. Her grades started to plummet, and soon after relocating, she dropped out of school. She moved out of the home to try and forget the night she nearly died. Herbert, who had taken time off to ensure that Charlie adapt to the changes, stayed for 2 years with him in Florida. But after meeting a woman, he decided to start his new life back in Indiana with his new lady friend and his 2 younger daughters. Charlie would undoubtedly need supervision, and Herbert asked his parents to come from Germany to take care of Charlie, at least until he graduated. Charlie did well, finishing school with good grades and obtaining a qualification in electronics, for which he had a real gift. His sister had a childhood sweetheart named Jim. Angela married Jim, a struggling musician, with whom she had a relationship since her early school years. Jim and Charlie became fast friends, even though Angela had told him everything that happened that cold night in January when she lost her mother. Despite this information, Jim felt Charlie was a close friend, and the 2 regularly went hunting and fishing. The marriage between Angela and Jim did not last, and Angela would later claim she believed the 2 high school sweethearts married too soon, but the friendship remained between Charlie and Jim. He even stayed with Charlie during his studies for a short period of time after the divorce. It was during a fishing trip among the smell of bait and after a couple of beers that Jim would open up to his brother-in-law about the pain, the rejection, and the heartache he felt about the divorce. As Jim vented about the loss of his marriage, Charlie calmly turned to him with a dead serious expression on his face and said, "If you really want revenge, you should kill her, cut out her heart, and eat it." Jim, intoxicated and confused, was taken aback by the remark that appeared to be made by Charlie in a dead serious manner about his own sister. His feeling of unease was even more heightened when he realized for the first time that Charlie would never kill his catch, preferring to fillet the fish while it was still alive. To Jim, these events and occurrences were disturbing, but not disturbing enough to call off the friendship. While in college, Charlie often stayed with Jim and his mother for a period of time. Angelo, however, never forgot the secret the family shared. She hardly saw Charlie in future years and would never leave her children alone with him. She made sure that there were clear boundaries when he visited, and he was never allowed to stay over.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
It's unclear if Jim was in denial about his friend and his strange ways, but Jim invited Charlie to go on a double date with his new girlfriend, Nancy, and her friend, Terry. Sparks immediately flew and the two were dating frequently after the first time they met. They married later, but Terry soon noticed some of Charlie's strange tendencies. Charlie often took fishing trips alone and was also fond of reading medical books, as if he was studying for a doctorate and had to have intimate knowledge about every part of the anatomy. He had a massive poster, the likes of which you would find in a biology class, with half the body showing muscle and veins and the other half showing all the bones of the body, posted behind his door. What made the poster odder was the fact that Charlie by no means had an occupation that would require intimate knowledge about the inner workings of the body. The poster was clearly that of a woman with her hair done up in a bun. This poster would eventually find its way onto the back of Charlie's bedroom door, which he would eventually share with his wife. To this day, no one could understand how she could allow such a creepy and aesthetically disturbing item in their bedroom. Regardless, the two met in April 1985 and were married on the 29th of August 1986, and everyone who knew the couple would describe them as blissfully happy. The wedding was small, with only Nancy and Jim in attendance and no other family members invited. Friends of the pair would comment secretly that they wished their own relationships had the intimate and loving energy that existed between Charlie and Terry. Terry left her job at the retail shop and became a dental assistant, while Charlie was still working for Raytheon. The two would pack each other's lunches, just because they believed it would taste better if it was made by someone you loved. The marriage on the inside, however, was not all heart-shaped candy and red roses. Before the two married, Jim urged Charlie to tell Terry about his past, and when Charlie gave a non-committal nod, Jim threatened him that if he did not, Jim would. Angela also had the same discussion with her brother, and both presumed that he had when Terry said during a conversation that considering everything, they had decided that having children was not a good idea. It was obvious that those who knew the secret had carried it for so long that the mere mention of what Charlie had done took tremendous effort. Instead of following up, those who knew presumed Terry knew about the night Charlie had killed his mother and her unborn child. The only telltale sign that the secret ever happened was the three ugly scars on Herbert's back as he cut the lawn without a shirt in the sun next to the pool. But like the army, there was an unspoken rule that you don't ask and you don't tell. Terry must have seen those same scars, but she trusted that her husband would tell her about them when the time came. Sadly, for her, it never came. On the 20th of September, 1978, a 13-year-old girl named Carol Ann Sullivan went missing. She appeared to have vanished from a bus stop. Carol Ann was feeling very proud of herself, as it was the first time she had made the walk from home to the bus stop. The kidnapping and murder would many years later be linked to Charlie, as police speculated that he must have abducted her from the bus stop. Her remains would be found a month later near her favorite fishing haunt of Charlie's. Her head had been removed and placed in a rusted paint bucket. As Jim and his mother were discussing the horrifying discovery over supper or while watching the news, Charlie, who had still been staying with them, burst out in uncontrollable laughter. When he noticed the shocked stares of his hosts, the laughter just grew and grew. Jim's mother had been so shaken by Charlie's reaction that she asked him to find other lodgings after this strange outburst. Something about her house guest had suddenly made her feel very uncomfortable. Shortly after the outburst, he was asked to leave. Charlie continued to fish near where the head of the little girl was found. By now, Charlie was working for Raytheon as a radar technician. He traveled across the country and even did work in the Bahamas. The pay was good, but he found the work repetitive. One afternoon while fishing, Charlie, according to his statement, stumbled upon a bag of cocaine. He slowly sold off the stash and was able to purchase a $250,000 house in the Keys. The house was magnificent, with a property on the beach. Charlie went back to working for Raytheon, which was contracted by the government to detect drug smugglers. It appears that being wealthy enough to retire at the age of 28 was not all he expected. On the 17th of December, 1986, a woman named Lisa Saunders decided to leave a party in Big Pine Keys early and make her way home on foot. Her body was found the following day, only a mile from where the party was held. She was badly mutilated, and her eyes had been removed. Her head had been smashed, and many of her organs were missing, including her heart. Her body was found not far from Charlie's home. Terry, who was described by all as a vivacious and bubbly person, had begun to keep a diary. Some entries would only contain the words, "weird day," while others would note the dates and times Charlie left the house and returned. She had clearly begun to be suspicious of her husband, who had come home from his apparent fishing trips, covered in blood, but with no catch. None of the entries indicated fear on her part, but her growing unease was visible in her writings. Sherry Padico was beautiful. She was valedictorian in her heyday, but life often throws up curveballs, and by the time her path crossed with that of Charlie's, she was living in a rowboat, not far from his home in Big Palm Keys. Her body, which was almost decapitated, was found by fishermen not far from where the couple had a picnic near a water pool on the 19th of July, 1989. Her stomach had been cut open, and her heart was missing. Her autopsy would determine that she had died from blood loss and/or drowning. Her boat showed deep cut marks. Investigators canvassed the neighborhood, but stopped a door or two before the Brandt household's dwelling. Charlie might not have been on the police's radar, but Terry was starting to feel uncomfortable with her knowledge about Charlie. Jim was in town playing in a band and invited the couple to the venue. When Charlie went to the bathroom, Terry told Jim about the day Sherry died. She came home early only to find Charlie in the fish cutting room, covered from head to toe in blood. He tried to explain it away by telling her he had gutted a fish, but Terry had no actual fish, and her suspicions about her husband were mounting. She asked Jim what she should do, and if she should call the police. His advice was to just forget about it, and that there was more than likely a logical explanation. All across Florida during the 80s and 90s, bodies would appear, grotesquely mutilated and butchered. But Charlie's records from the crimes he committed as a child was a sealed document, and therefore he was never even on the police's suspect list or radar. Darlene Toller was a mother of three with addiction issues. Her boyfriend would watch over her kids as she scoured the night in Little Havana to make money to put food on the table and tame the drug demon that lived in her. Her body was found wrapped not only in plastic, but a blue blanket. The blanket contained dog hair, and long after the case went cold, it would be determined that the dog hairs belonged to a friend's dog, which Charlie had taken to the vet in that very same blanket. Darlene was butchered, and her organs were so skillfully removed that investigators were astounded at the precision. Her death would also be linked to Charlie, who had kept a meticulous record of the mileage he traveled. The distance correlated with the route he traveled that day. The year 2004 was one of the years the Keys just could not escape hurricanes. Most foreboding should have been that one of the hurricanes was called Charlie. Hurricanes were part of the price you paid to live in paradise, and when the storm warnings came, Charlie and Terry would board up their home and stay at Terry's niece's home in Orlando. Terry was like a surrogate mother to Michelle Jones, and the three would always have a great time during their visits. Michelle was a very successful young woman, working for the Golf Channel. Her condo was luxurious, with a large swimming pool and enough room for everyone. At 37, Michelle was a sales executive who had the world in the palm of her hand. Charlie was very excited to see his niece. He would joke around with his friends, calling her Victoria's Secret. He had undoubtedly gone through her underwear drawer, because that was the brand of undergarments Michelle would buy. After his last crimes, investigators would also find many Victoria's Secret catalogs in his home. On Thursday, the 9th of September, 2004, Terry and Charlie began boarding up their home against the storm. They arrived at Michelle's home on the 10th of September and had a great time, which included Debbie, one of Michelle's best friends. Deciding she was too intoxicated, Debbie stayed over. At about 2 a.m. in the morning, she made her way to Michelle's kitchen for a drink of water. There she found Charlie, pacing up and down, occasionally staring with a glazed look at the butcher block that contained Michelle's kitchen knives. When he noticed her, he did not say a word, but just stared openly at her breasts. The entire experience freaked her out so much that she left the next morning, certain if she stayed, something bad was going to happen. On the 12th of September, Terry and Charlie went to visit Charlie's father. Later in the afternoon, the gang then went to Jennifer's home for supper. Charlie's behavior was odd and restless. He told Terry that he wanted to go back to their home in the Keys. Terry convinced him to stay a little longer. Angela was supposed to join them for supper, but she had a previous engagement. She called her brother and tried to make future arrangements for them to meet. He replied no and said that they would be staying with Michelle. When it was time to leave, Charlie hugged his father and sister longer and harder than usual, as if he were saying goodbye for keeps. By Monday, the 13th of September, the storm had subsided. Terry was now ready to go, but to her surprise, Charlie wanted to stay for a day or two longer. Lisa, another friend of Michelle's, was supposed to come over to dinner that evening, but Michelle called her close friend and told her it was not a good idea. Terry and Charlie had been drinking heavily and were arguing constantly. Later that evening, Michelle's mother called her, but her phone went straight to voicemail. This was unusual because the two would talk to each other daily. Terry was also not answering her phone, and by that evening, Michelle's mother was concerned enough that she called Debbie and asked her to go to the house to check if everything was okay. Debbie had also been trying to get a hold of Michelle to make plans for a girls' trip the following week, and she felt uneasy about the lack of communication from her friend. It was late in the evening when Debbie arrived at Michelle's home. She found all the cars still in the driveway, but got no response when she knocked. Debbie had a spare key for Michelle's house and tried to unlock the door. The key wouldn't work, likely because it was locked from the inside with Michelle's key, and in the end, this would be a blessing. Debbie moved around to where the garage was and decided to see if she could see anything through the window. The image that greeted her would haunt her for the rest of her life. Charlie hung from a noose he had manufactured from a bedsheet. The Florida heat had sculpted his dead form into a purple mass with bulging eyes and a protruding tongue. The overwhelming shock and panic drove her to call the police. Investigators found it easy to open the front door, but once inside, the horror of what had unfolded was evident. Terry lay on a sofa with a t-shirt and her pajama pants pulled down in an act of humiliation. Sources vary, but she had received between 7 and 10 stab wounds, so deep that they penetrated the sofa pillows beneath her. It was, however, in Michelle's room where the real nightmare that would haunt seasoned police officers awaited them. Michelle was unrecognizable. Her body had been mutilated, and her head was removed and placed next to her body, almost as if Charlie wanted her to see, even in death, what he had done to her. It also appeared that he had brushed her hair. Her breasts had been removed, and her intestines, which appeared to have been cleaned for inspection, lay in a lined bin next to her bed. Her rib cage had been opened, and her heart, which had also been cleaned, was removed. An autopsy would later reveal that she had been anally raped after death. The room was covered with blood-soaked towels and Victoria's Secret underwear, some of it torn as if he had tried to put it on. Her leg was severed and lay next to the bed. The killing wound was a stab to the back, which likely happened as he surprised her in the bathroom as her back was turned to him. It was also clear that after having his playtime with Michelle's body, Charlie had showered, dressed in clean clothes, and hung himself in the garage. As veterans ran out of the house, vomiting on the lawn, Debbie began to call relatives. Herbert was eerily quiet, but Angela immediately went to the police station and finally told investigators the secret they had been keeping for so long. Angela told investigators everything, which helped tremendously with connecting the dots. They read Charlie's journals, followed his meticulous record-keeping of miles, and on his computer, they found hundreds of disturbing, violent, pornographic images, autopsy photos, and snuff films. They studied his method of killing, and Debbie told of a time she caught Charlie watching her secretly as she bathed in the lake. When she asked him what he was doing, he said nothing and just slithered back into the woods. In the end, the four murders mentioned earlier would all be linked to Charlie. Investigators estimated that he could also be linked to between 20 and 27 other murders, but there was unfortunately not enough evidence to do this definitively.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with 3 murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
When it comes to the Dr. Phil show, people have many opinions, and I'm sure not many of our listeners are fans, but he managed to get Herbert, Angela, Jim, Michelle's parents, and her sister on the show to discuss the damage the secret had done and what would telling it had prevented. Herbert sat stoic. Angela still seemed to fear her dead brother, and Jim tried his best to explain the circumstances surrounding the secret. Michelle's family, on the other hand, was consumed in pure rage, as Dr. Phil tried his best to promote and up his ratings. All I saw was 6 people so many years later, still wrapped tightly in a blanket of pain, shame, and guilt. It would be a perfect world if we could see the future and, by predicting problems, find solutions to avoid them. But we don't live in a perfect world, and out there, somewhere in and around Florida, I am sure victims of Charlie Brandt have almost been forgotten and will never get the justice they deserved. This is a portion of the episode of the Dr. Phil Show about the Charlie Brandt case.
Well, Sean, Michelle's brother, is also joining us. So, Mary Lou, Bill, Sean, I'm glad to meet y'all. I hate the circumstance. I wish we were talking about something else, anything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I've read some of the police reports, and I mean, these are seasoned law enforcement officers that were traumatized and sick in the front yard. They said they had never seen anything like this at all.
No, they said in their 21, the chief investigator said in his 26 years at the time of his work, he had never seen anything like it. He said, you have 3 distinct crime scenes here. And they didn't know who Michelle was. We got a call from the sheriff and he asked for dental records.
You knew Charlie, right? And what was he like, Sean?
Nice, quiet, unassuming. He was just like your, everyday
guy. Kept to himself?
Yeah.
Do y'all believe that Terry had any idea of his past?
Absolutely.
Absolutely not.
No.
You don't think there's any way that he had told her about this, confided in her?
Terry was a person who couldn't keep a secret, and especially from her sisters. There were 5 girls in her
family. She would have told you.
We'd have known. Yes, we would have.
If you could tell Terry something, say, look, you can't share this with anybody, just me and you, okay? It would get spread. I mean, just that's the way it is. She's a jovial, fun person to be around. And if you tell her something like that, it would spread like wildfire. And she wouldn't have stayed with him. No question.
We did a poll. 78% of the people said, if somebody had something dark past, I'd let them leave it in the past. I wouldn't tell. You all clearly disagree with that for
Absolutely.
Obvious reasons. Let's take a break. Next, there was one other person besides Charlie's sister, Angela, and their father who knew the family secret. Well, we're going to meet that person. That's Jim. This is the person that introduced Charlie to Terry. And he never revealed the secret of what Charlie told him about cutting out a woman's heart. One of the things we're talking about today is the dilemma that everyone in their lives has faced. What do you do with what you know? Is there a threshold where you feel like you have to tell? Well, my next guest didn't. That's Jim. Jim knew Charlie because he married Charlie's sister. But little did he know that when he married into the family, he would become entwined in a real-life Stephen King novel. His own brother-in-law was a murderer, and he held the family secret, a secret that if he had just told, may have saved lives. Take a look.
I met Charlie Brandt's sister, Angela, when I was 16. We got married about 18 months later. Angela told me about Charlie's past before we got married. She goes, I have something I have to tell you. Well, my brother killed my mother. I wasn't quite prepared for that at all. I didn't believe it. One day, we went over to Angela's father. And he was mowing the yard without his shirt on. And he had these scars. There was no mistaking it was a bullet hole. And now I am aghast. She was telling me the truth. Now all kinds of things are racing through my mind. And she had said it more than once that she was still frightened of him at times. After Angie's and I split, Charlie and I actually became closer. Somehow we got on the topic of revenge. He looks at me and goes, well, you know what the perfect revenge is, Jim. I said, well, what is it? You kill somebody, and then you cut their heart out, and you eat it. I didn't know what to say. I was dating a girl named Nancy, and Charlie had inquired if she had any friends that she thought would be interested in palling around with all of us. Terry was Nancy's friend. Charlie and Terry hit it off and started dating. After 6 months, Charlie expressed to me he was going to ask Terry to marry him. I told him that you have to tell her about your past. Charlie told me that he told her about his past. I came down to the Keys, and I hadn't seen them in quite some time. Terry told me that she was considering calling the sheriff because she had walked in of the utility room, and Charlie was covered with blood. That was the last time I ever saw Terry and Charlie. A friend called and told me Charlie had killed his wife and niece, and Charlie committed suicide. Charlie fooled everyone. I feel terrible. I missed it. I will never completely heal from this. I gotta compose myself. I don't wanna cry on camera.
Well, Bill and Mary Lou have never spoken to Jim and asked him why he didn't tell. And of course, this is their opportunity. Jim, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming. And
okay.
You made a decision to say something to Charlie rather than to Terry. Take me through that decision. 78% of the people in our poll agreed with you, but take me through your decision. How did you decide that?
At first, I'd like to say I'm very sorry for all this occurring. At the time, I felt it was his place to tell her, not for me to go and tell his fiance, you know, there's something about Charlie that you need to know. And I talked to him on the phone and I said, look, you've got to tell Terry. And he's, no. And I said, if you don't tell her, I'm going to tell her. And he said, okay, then I guess I will.
So you did think it was important for her to know.
Absolutely.
But you left it to him.
Correct.
Tell me what's going through y'all's mind.
You thought he told, but you had the opportunity. And do you know how many people's lives have forever been changed? It's so hard for me to understand. And I know there's 78% that said they wouldn't tell, but I'm telling you, in our world today, it is just unacceptable.
I truly believed that he handled that business that I had discussed with him. Also, I had conversations with Terry that confirmed my personal feelings that he had indeed informed her. And when I introduced Terry and Charlie, how on earth would I know that they'd ever get married? It was just a gathering, an innocent gathering of friends.
You were the best man at his wedding.
Yes.
And at some point, there was another opportunity in a bar in Miami. And Terry told you about this experience with the blood.
That's
and
right.
You could have had an opportunity
she,
to tell
that's
him.
How I knew she knew. Because she referred to it in our conversation.
She referred to what?
The mother incident. She's
well,
saying,
I want to call
the sheriff because I know what happened with him and his mother.
Well,
that's
that
what I'm
well,
trying
my understanding
to tell you.
From what you said initially was that you understood that when Terry saw Charlie, he turned, you know, where you been? Because dinner's ready, you know, and he turns around, he's got blood all over him. And he says, what does it look like I've been doing? I've been cleaning fish. But he had no fish. There was no fish in the sink or on the sink.
Let me fill in some blanks for people here to be sure we haven't glossed over something. There was a point in time when you and Charlie were talking about revenge or getting even with someone.
Much
right?
earlier.
Right. Much earlier. And he said what to you?
He said the best way to get revenge is to kill somebody, cut out their heart, and eat it.
Okay. Now, this was during the period of normalcy.
It was the
right?
first weird thing I had ever heard gotcha. Out of him. After
and then
six
the second
years.
Thing we're talking about is she walked in on him one day covered in blood, right, in the laundry room, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was simultaneous with...
There was a murder that occurred in that area the same day that he showed up with his blood all over him. So was he involved in it? My God, I don't know. You know
she
so.
Said that to who?
This guy, Jim.
She said that to you?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, I want to get all the cards on the table here because the truth is, this gets worse. We'll take a look.
After the murders, there were a number of inquiries from law enforcement agencies around the country.
At one point, they were investigating 26 different cases. Charlie was formally charged with two of those. One of them was Sherry Parisio, and the other one was Darlene Tolliver. It turned out that Charlie Brent was a serial killer. Would Terry have married Charlie had she known that he had killed his mother? No, ma'am. She would not have married Charlie, period.
And our Terry and Michelle would still be alive with us today.
We now know he killed his mother, her unborn baby, attempted to kill his father and sister, killed Terry, killed Michelle, two other murders that we now know about, others that are being investigated. We're talking about a serial killer here, a predator among us.
Yes.
You think Terry knew. You all say no way she knew.
Shouldn't you have said there's something you need to know about him before you get too serious about him? Or?
We have to take a break. These horrific murders not only affected Michelle and Terry's immediate family, Michelle's best friend Debbie, which we just talked earlier about, actually found Charlie hanging from the rafters of the garage. When we come back, we're going to hear how she stared a serial killer in the eye and narrowly escaped death herself. We'll be right back.
One of Michelle's friends was visiting one night and got up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water, and she saw something out of the corner of her eye and turned to see Charlie staring at her. It was frightening. She went back to the bedroom and climbed in the bed and said to Michelle, man, this guy's strange. Michelle said, oh, he's a big teddy bear.
Well, Debbie and Peggy were two of Michelle's best friends. Now, Michelle is the daughter here, and it was Debbie who got the call from Mary Lou to please check on Michelle when no one had heard from either Michelle or Terry in 2 days, which is very unusual. Now, Debbie and Peggy are joining us live via satellite from the house that this tragically happened in. Debbie, let me start with you. Something happened the night before that makes you think that you may have foiled his plans. Tell me about that.
I had spent the night here with Charlie and Michelle and Terry. And, sorry, I'm very nervous. And we had, you know, a great dinner and some wine, sat in the jacuzzi. And then that night I realized probably not the best thing for me to go home. And I couldn't sleep because Michelle had two cats, and I'm very allergic to cats. And so I kept waking up in the middle of the night, probably, I would say, around 12:30 that night, and then approximately 1:30 and then 2:30. But every time I woke up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water, Charlie was in the kitchen.
He's up during the night. You keep getting up, and he's just up in there by himself.
Yes, sir. Just standing there, like, stoic looking and...
Fully dressed.
Yes, he was fully dressed. It was really awkward, but I didn't think at the moment, like, awkward, like, oh, he's going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
But I think, in hindsight, thinking back, that maybe that was his plan, and I was... prevented it, and maybe if I spent the night, the following night, that if I was there, it prevented that from happening again.
Well, or you could have been an additional victim as well, as you know. Peggy, let me ask you and Debbie both, did Terry know about this? Do you think she knew about this history with Charlie?
I have had doubts, and I don't blame Jim for what Charlie did. I don't know if him telling, if he did or not, if that could have prevented it, because there's also Charlie's father who never said anything, and there's also Charlie's sister who never said anything. There was other people that could have said something that didn't. So Jim wasn't the only one that did not say anything. I think he did try to clue Terry in whether or not she knew, and Charlie told, we'll really never know, but from her journal entries, you know, where she wrote weird night and the questioning about the cleaning of the fish and the blood and, you know, not following up with the police or looking into that further, like, where's the fish?
Tell me about these journal entries that were written.
I did see the journal entries, and the journal entries that I recall seeing described evenings where Charlie had an emotional day or Charlie was very emotional.
There's nothing in there that tells you she knew?
There was nothing that was any clear indication that she knew. We won't ever know, but in my heart, I don't believe my sister would have stayed with someone who had committed a violent crime like that.
Now, Bill and Mary Lou want to put something called Michelle Lynn's Law into place. And look, when a juvenile commits a violent crime, records cannot be expunged or sealed is basically what you're wanting to say. So in situations where you have a violent crime, a murder committed by someone that has their faculties intact, that should not be expunged because, as I'm saying, it is the best predictor of what they might do in the future.
If we had our dream come true about honoring our daughter and preventing other people from experiencing what we did, anyone, regardless of their age, who's committed a violent crime would be entered in a database that's retrievable by law enforcement. They could pull it up when they're investigating a crime, but it would also be a deterrent. If you knew that you were not discoverable, or if you knew that you were discoverable, then you would think twice about what behavior you manifest.
I said I would say what I have to do, what I would do with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight that I'm straight up, you didn't have, but I can tell you that personally, in this situation, would have said to Charlie, if it went beyond, hello, let's share a drink in a group, if he was going to be alone with that woman, I would have said, you need to tell her about this. And at some point, very soon, I would have looked her in the eye and said, you've met Charlie and talked to him now. How do you feel about him? Exactly. Anything jump out to you?
Exactly.
And if she says, no, seems like a really nice guy to me. I know he didn't tell you, so I'm going to tell you. I just have to say, I would give him the chance to tell. And if he told me he did it, I would believe it. But I would make eye contact with my friend, who I think I owe a duty, since I brought him into her world. I would want to make sure, if I've been the gatekeeper here and let him in this world, I just want to be sure. If you forgive and overlook, I'm proud of you, but I just want to be sure you made an informed decision. And so I would confirm that. It's easy for me to say now. It's different for you to say at the time.
Never in my wildest dreams.
Of course. And I think everybody understands that. There was a book written about this. I've read the book. It is called The Invisible Killer, The Story of a Serial Killer, Charlie Brandt. It's available in bookstores now. And as Bill said earlier, it really is a story of how he kind of hid in plain sight. I mean, you hang with normal people, you get painted with a normal brush.
This episode was written by Misdemeanor. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.